This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hello, and with me, Cam Rastan, today we have BFM's very own Mr. Tech Man, Matt Armitage.
Hey, Cam.
Hello, and we have the return of, how do we describe her? She's a playwright, and she's been an actress. Also, now, though, she's waiting for her results to find out if she's going to be Dr. Anne Lee.
Yes, yes, tell me where it hurts, Cam.
Our three topics this week are: topic number one is moving house, topic number two is the font of knowledge, and finally topic number three is the 8th World Culture
World Summit on Arts and Culture. The UN of Arts basically came to KL for 4 days.
Whoa, okay. So with topic number one, moving house. Now, I heard a factoid many years ago, and I tried to prove this factoid. But anyway, I was told a factoid many years ago that the three most stressful things in life are death, divorce, and moving house. And I have just moved house. And so I can attest to the fact that, yes, it is very stressful. But as it was, I kept thinking, why is it stressful? I mean, it's just moving house. It's not like a death or a divorce. Or I would imagine a long list of other things. But I find, you know, existentially, you come across so many aspects of who you are in the process of moving house. In that when you are leaving one place, there's you come face to face with the sum total of the life experience that happened in that place.
So how long were you in that place?
I was in 15 years in
there. Okay.
And then you can't help but assess the successes and mostly the failures that happened at that time. And a deep sort of sense of sadness of leaving, because it's like, well, it's an admission that I've somehow in some way failed, and I must therefore go to another place. And that you abandon a whole aspect of your life in order to take on a new part. And it reminded me, there is a place, I think it's in Turkey, modern day Turkey, one of the earliest settled communities that have been dug up. In it, they discovered that a burial practice that was done by these first settled peoples was that in the floor of their living room, essentially, poking out of the floor was the skull of an ancestor. So you move to a new house, but don't worry, because grandpa's head is going to be in the middle.
He's coming with you.
He's coming with you. So you always got a sort of sense of continuity as opposed to a departure. But in the great expanse of human history, most of our lives have been as unsettled people, pastoralists, foragers. The idea of living in a permanent spot now, which is so attractive to us now, is actually a very recent invention. So I'm just wondering, why do you find moving house stressful?
Well, it depends, yeah, on the memories of that place. I mean, if they were full of failure and all the rest of it, I'd be kind of quite happy to leave it to try somewhere else.
But you've moved house quite a lot, man. I know that. You're okay with that. You like to leave.
Yeah, yeah. Depart. But I think, you know, it is. I like the idea that you are changing, moving place, discovering somewhere new.
All right, Matt?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting that you said you see it as kind of a failure, because a lot of people, when they move, they see it as a successful move. It's generally people are moving up into somewhere bigger, or they're marking a certain point in their life. So for a lot of people, it's actually seen as that move upwards. But I think I must be a bit of a sociopath or something, because I don't really get attached to the places that I live in. I mean, I've been in my current house for about 10 years. And if someone said to me, you got to move tomorrow, I'd just call the movers and put all the stuff in and put it into the new place. I'm not kind of rooted so much on the memories created in the place. I just move on to the next one. I've still got the memories, and I'm going to create some new ones in the new one. So it's not so much of an issue to me. And obviously, before I came to Malaysia, I moved
country
quite a lot. Well, I moved country, but I moved a lot when I was living in London. You know, you have short-term leases. Mm. When I first came here, I was moving between every 6 months and every year for the first maybe 10 years. So you just get, like Anne said, like you said, Anne, you know, you get used to that process of going to another place, exploring something else, finding a new locality to be in, finding fun things to do around there, and just enjoying that new experience that new place brings you.
Well, fair enough. Maybe it's just me then. So by My issue is I don't want to go out the house at all. I don't.
Well, you work from home as well.
Yeah,
So you would have an extra attachment.
Yeah.
To the place, do you hoard things?
Not so much. Well, I personally don't think I do. I mean, Marie Kondo, she entered my life. I go, oh my God. But I think I'm okay. I mean, the bizarre thing, right? I needed to know that the ashes of my old cat who lived in that house with me, that I needed to know that her ashes would be the last thing that I would take out of that apartment. And when I knew, if I knew that, then I felt that everything was okay because I knew that I was carrying with me my past, as it were. My past would go with me to the new place. And I wasn't abandoning everything, and it hadn't abandoned me.
And it was much better looking than a skull of Grandpa.
Well, yeah, and also, I mean, bless him, you keep stubbing your toe on Grandpa.
can we? And he's got sharp teeth. Yeah.
Can we please move Grandpa to some other place? And also, I've always been fascinated by that, the idea of putting Grandpa there. Does that make any sense to you, that story they told of having Grandpa in the middle of the floor? Having the ancestor?
I mean, yes, it does. I mean, I originally come from a small country community where people didn't move around so much, before you go back 100 years and people wouldn't leave their village. Or if they did, they'd maybe leave their village once a year to go to the market town, and maybe once in a lifetime they might go up to the kind of county seat, the county capital, 40 miles away, and that would have been the effort of 3 or 4 days traveling. So I can kind of understand that. And also, I mean, my parents, when they first moved to the area that I was brought up, they lived in a small cottage next to a church, and they were actually bordering the graveyard, the cemetery. And the previous occupant of the house, his headstone was against the dining room window, literally.
I like that.
Is that kind of connection. Yeah. And smaller communities, I think, as you said, are much more rooted around those shared experiences and the people that came before.
Yeah. Roseanne, you're just like, let's go now.
Well, no. I mean, like, I think it's, I was just trying to think, photographs I take with me, I can move a lot of things, I can pack a lot of things, I can leave things for people to do packing, but photographs for me, I think, as long as I have those, I'm okay. I can be anywhere. And that includes a photograph of my mother's father, maternal grandfather, whose head was removed by Japanese soldiers in the Second World War. So he's one of the people who is in those, is one of those photographs that we take with us.
Wow, okay. Well, and on that, we...
Well, you set the theme.
Yeah, I didn't know you guys could bring up an actual story. I'm talking about 50,000 years ago. It's like, oh, yeah. Anyway, so now we move on to topic number two, Matt and the font of knowledge.
Yeah, I want to talk about a specific font. So it's a font that the company Apple has introduced. It's called San Francisco. It's not a massively well-known font, but it is quite ubiquitous. So Apple use it for pretty much everything on their operating systems. Anything where there is kind of a default system fault on an Apple product, most likely it's going to be San Francisco. Now, we all know, a lot of people have spoken over the last few years about Helvetica, and there have been movies about the font Helvetica and how fantastic it is. And I don't want to talk about the kind of science of the fonts so much, although, Anne, if you want to chip in with your fantastic knowledge of fonts, that would be awesome. But one of the things for me was I had an issue a few years ago where I had an ear problem and an eye problem that happened at the same time. And one of the things that I stopped being able to do was I couldn't watch TV or video because moving images made me very dizzy, very nauseous, and I couldn't read. Anytime I looked at a piece of paper with a font, anytime I looked at a screen with a font, it would just run. It would just be swimming. I could read maybe 3 or 4 words before I would get incredibly dizzy, and I would have to stop. Now, obviously, that had enormous impact on being able to work because I work as a consultant and I prepare presentations, but also it had an impact on the shows that I do for BFM because what would take me a few hours to prepare as a script or notes for a show was suddenly taking me about 3 days because I'd have to take breaks. So one of the things that I found during this was that Apple's operating system, or Apple Safari browser, has this thing called reading mode. So when you press this little button on the thing, the website disappears and you get a white sheet of paper and you just get the text from the thing.
Mm-hmm.
That made it much easier for me to read. I wasn't so confused by lots of things having on the page. So I could read maybe 300 words at a time and then take a break. So I could read short news items. Then when I started messing around with the fonts, because I think the default font was something like Palatino. And I started messing around and I got to San Francisco. And when I clicked on San Francisco, honestly, it was like magic.
Oh my God.
Happened. Okay. Suddenly, I could read the text. It was clear. It didn't make my eyes swim. It didn't make me dizzy. And I could start consuming long-form
content. Like in the old days.
Like in the old days, yeah. Wow. And one of the reasons for that is because San Francisco is based on Helvetica. But it's been retooled to make it very legible on devices with small screens.
Mm.
So, you know, we all know our phone screens are getting larger and larger. So the need for these kind of legible fonts on phone screens is kind of reducing slightly. But for devices like smartwatches and these smart speakers that people have, they have very small screens. So you need extremely clear fonts. And what Apple did with this font, apart from, you know, the usual rounding and shaping or whatever to increase the clarity, they did something very simple, which for me was this kind of secret sauce. They just increased the space between the letters to make it easier to see on smaller screens. But for me, that gave my eyes the space and the time to actually form the word without seeing everything as this big swimming mass. And suddenly I was able to see sentences and recognize words. Again, it was, you know, it's often when we talk about fonts, people say, oh, just make it bigger. You know, just make the font bigger and you'll be able to read it. But that doesn't help when the letters are all crowded together. This, simply by separating the letters ever so slightly, allowed me to read again.
Well, a man's life saved by a font. Never heard that.
I didn't want to talk about the science of it because the impact on me is such a personal one.
And you're a font lover.
Well, they used to call it typeface, but I'm totally into the art and science of. I mean, there are good reasons why you've identified it as the spacing or the letting between the letters. Yeah. That was a very important aspect. I find that the Helvetica, for example, I mean, these are, you know, this sort of sans serif or clean typeface, it does make a big difference when you're seeing it on the screen. You can get a little bit crazy about the precision of it. I remember this, National and Panasonic use Helvetica. And I remember a series of ads that we did once, and it was something very close to Helvetica. I forget what it now is because it's completely, even now, you know, it's sort of blanked out. And it was the wrong typeface. And the client just kind of called up, and my head, you know, I almost got lost my job because I had the wrong typeface. Mm. You know, that particular typeface says everything about what National and Panasonic, Panasonic, I think, is still exists.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
And even that one mistake was something that could a person could lose their job.
Mm.
Because it's very, you know, these have very particular effects. They do.
Yeah,
they
of are, course.
Mm. Mm, yeah. Well, I was thinking how with Romans, the ancient Romans, right, they would carve the letters into stone. So I wonder if Matt Armitage would be able to read that. But also what they did with their ones, they had no punctuation.
Mm.
So the whole thing is like War and Peace would just be one continuous thing. And so you would have to work out where, and I guess they just instinctively knew where the end of the word was, or sentence for that matter. Or did they even think in terms of sentences? And I wonder if, I mean, it's a bizarre thing that we live in now where Well, one, printed words in and of themselves is a very modern invention. But the word on the screen is so very modern. I wonder if, Matt, maybe lots of people who are suffering from...
Quite possibly. I mean, I've not been able to gather any kind of information about this, but certainly Apple created this font to address that need of legibility on small devices. I mean, not for people like me who can't focus on the text, but simply to make things clearer.
This is like digital dyslexia, then. I mean, it's like, the way you describe it, it sounds like dyslexia.
No, because the same thing happens on a piece of paper. I still...
Or paper as well.
Yeah, right? I find it much easier to read from a screen. I still can't read from a piece of paper. I still can't read a paper book.
Even though it's printed out in San Francisco?
Well, what I have done actually is, because Apple allows you to download this font for other uses, well, you can go to their developer site and download it. If you use it for commercial uses, you have to pay a license fee, but you can download it and add it to
personal
your
use,
personal
yeah.
use.
Yeah.
So okay. I've added it to my Kindle.
Officer, it's personal use only.
So yeah, I've added it to my ebook reader and I can read that in short bursts, but it's still much easier to read from a computer screen where I can scroll.
Well, it's a heartwarming tale that we have here on Better Culture.
I wonder why they picked San Francisco apart from, you know, open-minded.
Oh, do you know? I'm guessing because it's
Apple's
of Apple.
Apple's very San Francisco, isn't it?
Yeah. They wanted something kind of Tech Valley-ish. And also because all the good names have been taken already.
Wouldn't it be great, though, if Apple actually started Batu Gajah? That'd be a great name.
Sandakan.
Okay, so we move on, though. And in a moment, we'll be talking about the, Anne is going to tell me, the 8th Global Cultural Conference here on A Bit of Culture, BFM 89.9. And we're back with myself, Cam Ruslan, Matt Armitage, and now Anne Lee, who recently attended here what's going to be a departure from A Bit of Culture and had a lot of culture at the 8th
World Summit of Arts and Culture. And it was organized by the International Federation of Arts Councils and Cultural Agencies. So this really was sort of like top level, heavy hitters, and about 450 participants from over 80 countries who came to KL for the 4 days. And most of it was located at KL PAC. And I have to say that, you know, well, the theme, first of all, was mobile minds, culture, knowledge, and change. And I kind of haven't been in with cultural lingo for some time. I mean, in the late 90s, there was sort of, you know, creative economies. It was sort of just coming in, I think. But at this conference, you had ideas such as, or notions such as, if we know what corporate citizenship is, what is cultural citizenship? There are a lot of questions generated at the conference, but the idea is that, you know, you're trying to get a view of what's happening in the world and how to lead change. So it could have gone all over the place. I mean, that's a very, you know, broad theme overall. But for me, the person who most kind of anchored it was Karima Benoun, who is the UN Special Rapporteur for Cultural Rights. And she made this point, which is, you know, cultural rights, it's now a decade since we've been talking about cultural rights. And what are cultural rights? Well, cultural rights include that everybody can participate in being able to share and express what their culture is, everybody. So if you have a cultural rights approach, does everybody in the country or in that area have a chance to be able to do and express what they are about? And of course, there are ways in which you measure impact and measure effect. That these are still there, you know, kind of, do you look at it as something which is, in terms of social change? Do you look at it in terms of, you know, the dollar, the financial impact? So the idea was that this was up for the 4 days, you know, this was all up for discussion. And I thought she made the point, for example, that, you know, cultural rights are a universal right. They're like human rights. They're like, you know, women's rights. They are universal. But Fahmy, our very own MP for Bangsa South now.
How dare you? Crunchy North or something. Something crunchy.
So Fahmy made this point because after each keynote address, there was a kind of moderator, you know, to sort of unpack what had been discussed. And he made the point, which is, look, when we talk about cultural rights, it's seen as very foreign. It's very important to sort of be able to express this. Although it's universal, we say it's universal. What is it in the vernacular? You know, how do we have a vocabulary, a syntax, and so forth, which can debate with those who would easily say, hey, this is Western, this is foreign, ini bukan kebudayaan kita, whatever it is, you know. And I thought that was a very important question, because it's kind of like you kind of go to sleep, you eat, you know, it's a universal right, but that doesn't actually mean anything, because if you say, no, but this is according to the UN, you know, it is a legal fact. Karima, who's half Algerian and half American, she's also a professor of law at UC Davis. So for her, the kind of, you know, this is a universal law, but the problem is it's not, you know, it is not necessarily seen.
But can I ask, though, these conversations, these phrases, are these designed by cultural, not practitioners, are they, cultural bureaucrats, say, in order to find the right set of words to persuade the money people, government, to part with money? So that you go to the ministry and go, hey, it's cultural human rights. And the ministry goes, yeah, I love that. How much do you want? Where do I sign? I mean, is that what it is? It's just like finding buzzwords to persuade them.
No, I don't think so. I mean, I think, you know, it's very important to be able to coin things which you feel you know, if you go into a debate, what are the arts for? Sorry.
Yeah, words for that argument, actually. No, it's true, though, we do.
Yeah, and we need them in, I don't know, like... one form of Hakka or one form of Kelantan Malay. So one of the things is that the UN declaration and all the notion of festivals came out after a period of great conflict where people have killed each other for reasons of religion or for reasons of culture. You know, whatever it is. So how do we, you know, it is about love and humanitarian kind of, you know, it's like, how do we use arts and culture for ways that unify, for ways that, and I think, you know, Edin, and I'm highlighting the Malaysians there because there were very few Malaysians at, relatively few Malaysians at the conference, although people had been involved in the organizing committee, and of course JKKN was a co-organizer. But Edin, for example, talked about how we can use the arts for things which are strategic, but actually there's something which is anarchic also. How do we express... How do we find a language to express the inexpressible? Or if we are going to allocate funds, there's a very practical or pragmatic sense of what you do with money. Yeah. It was very important to sort of look at how technology is also, Matt, this is your area, but is completely changing. If we talk about, you know, so I was very taken with some of the African representatives. So, for example, Patrick Sam from Namibia, who is chair of the National Arts Council there, he made this wonderful presentation to me, which was about making the most with the least. And he presented some amazing figures of how, you know, the future is African. You know, we're going to be, there are so many, the population is going to be huge. The usage of technology, I mean, the basic stuff of what we, I don't mean the methods and techniques, I mean the hardware notion of technology, is very, very widespread. So he was talking about, you know, the Silicon Savannah and, you know, and this kind of... So these have impacts on what our present paradigms are completely incapable of understanding or projecting what are going to be our future ones. But we have to think about it. Yeah. How do we think about that?
Well, Matt, I mean, you... Technology?
No, definitely from a technology standpoint. But, I mean, one of the things that I do with respect to technology is generally looking at these big technology companies, but looking at things from a consumer perspective. So looking at where there are these kind of mismatches in information, for example, between the stuff that's coming down from the tech companies and what people actually want. And I think it's interesting that you said that one of the big themes of the conference is cultural rights. But at the same time, there weren't many Malaysians present. So whether that's for reasons of advertising, whether that's for reasons of the cost of actually attending. So that's another example of one of the big organizations having this disconnect between the grassroots and the people that they're supposed to be communicating with, because those people aren't able to gain access to this thing. So, you know, it's fantastic that we have the UN of Arts being hosted in Malaysia, but for example, I didn't know that it was
presumably it was just Malaysia just happened to be the venue for international
For sure, but you know we talk about Malaysia not being on the kind of world map in terms of art. So when you get something of this scale coming in, you would expect it to have a lot more noise and fanfare, especially when it's being promoted by a government department. You would expect it to be plastered everywhere, for there to be Facebook ads going out left, right and center, for there to be media coverage, and for there to be invitations sent out to artists to actually attend this kind of conference.
It's true. A bit of culture didn't get any. We didn't receive any.
Well, you know, as the point was made, you know, this all of this discussion is deeply political, not just about practice. I think for those who were involved, you know, the idea is that, well, Malaysia did pitch, Kuala Lumpur pitched for the opportunity to have the conference at the summit in KL. And I think a lot of work was done on the ground, by the ministry. It's just kind of sort of part of the contradiction of what's happening right now in Malaysia Baru, that the minister, the same minister who talked about, the importance of culture and cultural rights, actually said there are no gays in Malaysia. You know, in the same week, it was great. It
was okay. So just to round this one off then, Anne, you went there and you have now walked away. What are the key things that you walked away with? And do you feel optimistic or otherwise?
Yes, I definitely feel optimistic because of the kinds of initiatives that some people are doing all over the world. You know, like, okay, so if arts councils are an outdated version of, you know, how you can spread and commit to, you know, the finances towards something of unifying peoples of different backgrounds and involving as many people as you can. What are the new ones? I mean, are they hubs? The British Council had a session around hubs. The people were saying it's social enterprise. But one of the examples was Sabah Khalid from Pakistan. She gave an example of how with less than, you know, US $100 or something like that, she created this a chat line and a figure online who her name is Aurat Raji, and she is used by kids, girls, to understand about their rights. You know, what can they grow up to be? And it's a game. It's a game that they play instead of kind of like, you know, someone coming boring, coming to give you a lecture about these rights. It's a very, very participatory, very fun activity and was very cheap to do.
And this is a physical, this is not a digital thing. This is like physical in a room people meet.
No, it's digital, you take the your laptop and you meet with girls in very, you know, further rural areas and so forth.
So it's like a chat bot.
Yes,
kind of
exactly.
Thing.
Yes. Yeah. And one of the points was, but, you know, how do you cope with when somebody, you know, kind of sabotages it and you get all of these comments? And she said, well, yeah, it is the truth. We do have to deal with that. But still we continue, you know.
Yeah, of course. I mean, that's just part of the process. It doesn't reduce the impact of having it done in the first place.
Yeah,
for sure.
Okay.
And can I say just one more thing? Well. When it came to the closing, there were two people who spoke and kind of reminded us of all the 3-day kind of very intense kind of discussions and workshops and everything. There was Jo Mamboya from Kenya. She's the executive director of Go Down Art Center, and Kathy Rowland, director and founder of artsequator.com,
from Malaysia. Yes,
from Malaysia. And Kathy, to me, put the heart back into the conference because she talked about how, look, you know, we've had this, do words have meaning? Mm-hmm. We've just gone through this kind of marathon of words, and how, you know, some of these contradictions that we're having right now in Malaysia, for example, we assume that these things can happen in areas of there's no conflict, there's no harmony. But right now, as we speak, there are very important contradictions where an artist who wants to say something cannot, and then there are very severe consequences about that. And she, you know, she was moved, I think, and that moved the rest of us in terms of remembering about what freedom of expression is, but being able to say that and talk about that in ways that cannot just be dismissed as Western.
Well, thank you, Anne, a bit of culture journalist on the spot in the at the 8th, one more time, the
World Summit of Arts and Culture.
Sounds great. Is it? I mean, it's annual?
I think it's Every two years, because it's a big thing that they have to organize.
Okay. But, and also, there are no there are no gays in Malaysia. I had no idea.
Yeah, no.
Oh, okay. That's
we're,
new. That's
we're very
great.
Special yeah. that way.
Well, just one in the village.
Yeah, yes, from a very famous sitcom. We move on now to the final part of the show, recommendations. We recommend something that we think might be of interest, and I go first. My recommendation is Brickfields, but in a slightly different way. So Brickfields, as you probably know, is an area in Kuala Lumpur, which is in a way one of the oldest areas, in that it's one of the oldest made of bricks areas. And I want to recommend Brickfields as a religious site. I was recently there for a very sad occasion, for a funeral, and it really reminded me that in Brickfields you have, for instance, you have a Ceylonese Hindu temple. Just down the road, you have what was originally a Ceylonese, but is now just essentially a Buddhist temple, a very large one. Right next door to a Methodist church, you have several, I think, Christian places. The place where I was a Syrian Orthodox church. And then you have basically just about every religion under the sun. I don't know if there's a mosque around there. I don't think there is. It's the one absence. I'm not sure.
No, there is, because I actually went on a religious walking tour of Brickfields a few years ago. Yeah, one of the KL Arts organizations, I can't remember which one now, organized this kind of weekend of tours, and you would actually meet with the representatives in the church, whether it's pastors or imams or whatever, and they would talk about the history of that particular temple or building. There was a bit of a reception in some of them. It's absolutely fascinating.
And I can't think of anywhere else on earth that has that much religion in one small spot. And even if there was somewhere else on earth, it would be in all their tourism brochures and saying, look at us, how diverse we are and accepting. But in Malaysia, it's like, well, of course, what? It is different. It's unusual. It's perhaps unique. I mean, we've all kind of traveled a little bit. You been anywhere that is anything like Brickfields for the diversity of religions in one spot, even remotely?
Or out of the country, you mean, not like in Malacca or...
Yeah, out of this country, anywhere?
I'm not sure. I imagine with all the different Orthodox churches, Jerusalem would have a fairly large variety.
And a big Buddhist temple as well.
Perhaps not so much on the Buddhist side. But no, I think you're probably right. I can't see anything of that kind of diversity. Nothing comes to mind anyway.
Yeah, maybe in India or something, maybe somewhere. So anyway, so that's my recommendation. Brickfields, but from a religious aspect, have a look at that. So, Matt.
Well, mine is kind of the other aspect of the religious circle, I suppose. Mine is the new Ricky Gervais show on Netflix called Afterlife, which is dealing with a man who's lost his wife to cancer, and he feels the loss very badly, and he becomes an absolutely disgusting human being who feels that the death of his wife has freed him to essentially have no conscience, to say anything he likes to anybody and to do anything he wants. It starts off kind of the usual Ricky Gervais thing that, you know, you're provoking people and trying to cause offense for the sake of it. But it quickly kind of transforms through the series to him kind of regaining some of this sense of humanity. And one of the things that we see with series now is that there tend to be too many episodes for the ideas. There are so many series on that you just think, oh gosh, why couldn't you have done this in 6 episodes instead of 13? This is actually the opposite. I think there are only 6 or 8 episodes, and the resolution happens far too quickly. You think, yeah, I think it's 6 episodes, and you're left feeling, you know, this would really have been much better with a 10 or a 12.
Isn't it?
Yeah, and also it's another one of these shows that's gone back to the idea of doing 30 minutes, between 25 and 30 minutes, and keeping it very tight, keeping it very funny, and not simply letting it drift to 45 minutes because there are no ad breaks and there are no kind of restrictions on the format. So it's nice. It's short, sharp, and there should be more of it.
Well, I mean, basically the format you're talking about is BBC. I mean, you know.
Essentially, but you know, we've kind of lost that a little bit with this move to streaming because, you know, if you don't have that sense of overrunning. So you can stretch to 36 minutes or 42. Yeah, if you look at a lot of series, they'll vary in length between about 38 and 52 minutes, depending on episode to episode.
Okay. Yeah. So what's it called again?
It's called Afterlife, and it's Ricky Gervais.
And it's a Netflix
series. It's on
series. Netflix. It's
yeah.
a Netflix series.
It's it? A Netflix series, yeah, commissioned yeah. for Netflix.
Right, right. Okay. And Lee is, I'm sorry, Annie, time's up. What's your recommendation?
Well, I have something to dedicate to the minister who said that we have no gays in Malaysia. It's a website called queerlapis.com.
Oh.
And it makes for good, easy reading and informative reading. Yeah.
Okay. So just check that one out.
Yeah, check it out.
Okay, to find out that we do not indeed have... Okay. So that neatly brings us to the end of this week's show, where we've had revelations about... how moving house, I think, destroys a person, and if only granddad could be on the floor. That a man can read again, thanks to a font. And
absolutely.
And that culture in this country has perhaps a future if we can learn from global movements. And so only remains for me now to thank Matt Armitage.
Thank you, Cam.
I still want to say Matt Arbitrage every time. Eh?
You can. You can even say Matt Arbitrage. That's also fine.
And Anne Lee.
Thank you, Cam.
Good luck with your PhD results.
Yeah, I think it's another month to go. So
yeah, next time you're on the show, you should be Dr. Anne Lee.
Dr. Anne Lee, yeah.
Inshallah.
And myself, Cam Ruslan, and then please join us next week for another exciting episode of A Bit of Culture here on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.